Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to another episode of Tennis and Bagels. I was going to say tennisandbagels.com. I think I'm just way too into like work right now. Just everything is web and digital. So yeah, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. We talk about tennis. And I'm here again, joined by Owen from Popcorn Tennis. How are you doing, man?
Doing well. It's been a while since we did one of these.
How's Popcorn doing?
Should be an adventure. Doing well. Not a ton of big events going on right now, so going to try to ramp up coverage soon.
And Vansh, how are you doing, man?
Doing pretty good. Came back from vacation as soon as Wimbledon was over, and been following as much as I can. I usually don't follow as much during this time of the year, but I've been following a lot more than I usually do in previous years, because there've been some great storylines and some good things to analyze and talk about. So, and post Wimbledon clay and kind of now North American hardcourt swing starting. So it's
cool. There's obviously like during this little span between Wimbledon and American hardcourt, there's a bunch of like European clay court events, which some people call them random, but I guess like the nature of tennis, like as long as there's tournaments that you can fit in the calendar and there's budget, like why not? Players need money and points anyway, so yeah. And we had a few in the WTA, which is, by the way, like it has been kind of suffering a bit, like right in terms of a number of tournaments played. Like by the beginning of the year, they had really very few tournaments. I guess like at this time of the year, like pretty much at any point, like tournaments are very much welcome. And we had our very own world number one, Iga Świątek, playing in her home in Warsaw. So what do you guys make of it? Of her week in general?
Yeah, first of all, this was it was good to see Świątek back playing. Obviously, Wimbledon didn't go as well as she would have liked, losing to Cornet in the third round. But nonetheless, we got a chance to really appreciate this amazing streak that she was on of 37 matches in a row, and you know, longest in the 2000s. And she's playing in her hometown. First time I saw the stat. This is the first time she's played a WTA 250 in 3 years. So like, it is pretty insane, because it goes to show how smart her scheduling has been, how much she's dominated the big events, and how little other events that she's really played like throughout her last two or three years that she's been dominating. So so then she plays in Warsaw, and I think, you know, two things happened. One, she played an opponent who is really in form right now. Garcia, you know, had a great run at Wimbledon. She beat Raducanu. Before that, she won that tournament in Bad Homburg. She beat Bianca Andreescu in the final, down a set and a break. She used to be with the world number four. In 2017, she had this stint at the end of the year where she won 2 1000s and got to the semifinals of the year in championships, beating great players along the way. So we know she's capable of this kind of tennis. And what she did in this match is sort of what if you were to create like sort of a game plan against Świątek, which is really high risk and very, very few players can execute. And that is like attacking the second serve. And that's what she did extremely well. And she not only attacked it, she went for winners off of the second, straight up off the second serve. And that is extremely hard to do against Świątek, because she defends really well after the serve. And then she turns the point around and goes on offense. And she was having a hard time doing it in this match, because she was stepping in, taking the second serves early on both the forehand and the backhand, like just hitting shots with so much pace and going down the line really often in rallies, and just not really letting Świątek settle, just making her really uncomfortable, making her doubt that shot, making her go bigger on that wing. And, you know, if Świątek has a slight weakness, it's maybe that her second serve is just as a shot alone is maybe a little bit attackable, but it's, you know, she's, we know how difficult that's been to do to her, and only really Yelena Ostapenko and Danielle Collins and players like that, who, when they're really in form and having a red hot day, can really do that to her. So that's kind of what she did. But Swiatek still fought back. She still won the second set, 6-1. She lost the first set, 1-6. And then she broke when Garcia was serving for the match at 5-3. And then she had two game points to hold for 5-all. So I think, you know, there were parts of her game she probably wanted to clean up. But I think also she was playing at home and she probably felt a little bit of pressure, you know, because it's her home event. It's in Poland. Before that, she'd played like a charity event with Radwanska. And, you know, there was just, and that was on a hard court. And now this is on a clay court. Now she's going to go back to a hard court again, where I think the next step for her. So in terms of long term, it's not really too much of a worry. It's just more, you know, maybe players in the locker room might look at this and go, okay, So now she's 2-2 after going, you know, winning 37 matches in a row. But I don't think it really shakes up her confidence much. I think she'll go back to the drawing board and she'll try to focus on what's really important, the next step for her, which is just performing better in hard court majors. And she already has an Australian Open semifinal this year, which I think will give her a lot of confidence. And of course, she's one of the favorites.
Yeah. I'm not really worried by this. Like, I think it would be easy to look at this and say, like, okay, she really needs to improve her serve. But, and by all accounts, Garcia did completely demolish it. I mean, she hit 3 return winners in her very first return game. And then she hit a return winner on match point. But I don't know. I kind of look at this and say, like, that's too good from Garcia. Because you can point out that Swiatek's second serve is not the best in the world. But all the same, like, no one has been able to punish it like this in 37 matches. And so, like, when Collins did it at the Australian Open, she didn't miss a single second serve return that entire match. And when you look at what Garcia did here, it was just all power, all accuracy, all the time. Like, that's not something her opponents or anyone is going to be able to do regularly. So I'm sure she's working on the serve because it's probably the weakest part of her game. But, you know, it's not like an alarm bell or anything. Like, she's still going to win the vast majority of the time. Like you said, Vaughn, she was able to make this match really close despite getting breadsticked in the first set. I mean, I think it's sort of inevitable that there would be a little bit of a cool down after you win 37 matches in a row. But yeah, I still expect great things from her for the rest of the season.
And obviously she's a very smart player. She's one of the first players really to like be open about like working with a psychologist and things like that. So she will try her best to avoid any sort of mental like issues that she might have, like in terms of like mental blocks or like too much questioning. But it's definitely something to wonder, like when you go on a streak like that, like is this going to impact her in the sense that like will she be worried that she will never be able to like pull off like the same level of the incredible streak of like even sets won, not even just matches, but like she's won like something like 28 sets in a row or something like that. I'm not necessarily worried, like you said, but like I think it's just something that I think it's worth keeping an eye out, like for like how she comes out playing, like her next matches. Is she going to be more conservative? Is she going to go all out still? I still think she's going to go all out. I think that she will keep pushing to try to find a way. I think she's still pretty motivated, like in her young career. Like I feel like the things that worry me most about like a player not playing well is just kind of like losing motivation after like doing well, I guess, sort of in a sense what happened to Barty after she decided just to retire just because she didn't really want to do it anymore. So I guess if Barty had decided, for example, to keep playing, I don't think she would have kept the same level because she wasn't motivated, right? But yeah, in terms of the future, I do think that Swiatek will definitely be eyeing the US Open. I think she's accomplished a lot in the 1000s level, and she's won again at a Grand Slam level, a Grand Slam that she was basically supposed to win, and she pretty much dominated it. But I think that really next step for her, and what I think that she knows it and that she wants it, is to win a Grand Slam on hard court or on another surface really other than clay. And I think the US Open could be a really good opportunity for her to try that out and see how it goes. I definitely think that we should be seeing Swiatek on like firing on all cylinders at the US Open. But I definitely think that we're going to be seeing a lot of improvements and like little tweaks on her game, like already in Cincy and in Canada. So yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And she can only go up in those places. And I think you're in good shape when the game plan against you is to redline. I think that means you're pretty secure for the most part. And you know, and during her clay season, she only dropped three total sets, like once Garcia won the second, you know, won the first set here. So like she totally dominated the entire clay season.
Mm-hmm.
So not too worrying. And good for Garcia because she won the whole tournament and she didn't drop a set along the way the rest of the way, and she won her next two matches quite comfortably. And she's definitely put together a really nice run here. And you know, let's see if she can also continue it into the hard court. So
Vansh, I think you make a good point about when the game plan to beat you is to redline, because like if you redline successfully, that's going to work against anyone. Like I think an interesting case of that was with Sebastian Korda against Nadal at Indian Wells. I think, you know, he's not as good of a player, but he blasted the ball as hard as he could and he made a bunch of shots. And so it worked really well for a while. And so no one is immune to an opponent redlining successfully. And so I think like it could happen to Świątek again in the future, but like that's always a danger for every player, no matter how good you are. And Andre, what you were saying about burnout, I think it's kind of interesting that if I were her, and I'm sure she like has the best idea of what to do and her team, but if I were her, I might try to shift my focus from like trying to start another winning streak, maybe, to like trying to win a big event in isolation. Because I feel like historically, like it's not sustainable to like dominate for that long. Like by which I mean, I feel like when players do it, more often than not, they get burned out. Like I feel like with Djokovic, a lot of the time we've seen, he can win like three majors in a row and destroy everyone and then show up at a Masters 1000 and look almost bored. And, you know, every player is different. And I'm not saying that would happen to Świątek, but I feel like over the long term, focusing on the big events or maybe putting a little extra stock in the big events is more sustainable than putting pressure on yourself to win every match all the time. Not saying that's what she did in the winning streak. I actually thought she did a great job of maintaining perspective and not saying to herself, like, I need to like keep the streak going as long as possible, even though she did a great job of that.
Yeah, for sure. I think she was actually prepared that it would end soon, and she would. And I think how she responds to that is going to be worth telling, because she's, you know, she had like a little bit of a blip last year as well, and then she responded brilliantly. And when Ash Barty became number one, she filled that void like it was nothing. So. I think it shows.
I do like what you said though, like about like the fact that it was home, and I guess most players, if not all of them, do have a special place for their home tournaments, even as small as they are. They always like to come back and play in front of their home crowds, and it always means something special to them. In a way that, of course, like they all want to win the biggest tournaments, but I feel like the home tournaments it's just kind of like performing well in front of your parents type of thing.
She's a really big star
in your entire town.
She's absolutely such a big star in Poland. Like when I was watching the final, the stands were almost half empty, and not because Garcia isn't a great player, but just because
she
really
kind of drives the,
you know, carry
the conversation. So like I feel like she's obviously she obviously wants to come back to the tournament, to the home tournament. She probably wants to win it at some point. So we'll see more of her next, but I don't think this holds that much stock, actually, like as we were saying, like about what she's going to be doing in the next couple tournaments.
You mentioned home event, and go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, I was just gonna say, like, would you guys agree she's still the favorite for the US Open? Like, I think given what she's achieved on 1000 level events on hard courts, like she would be the favorite for me. Like, not to say not as big of a favorite as she was at Roland Garros, but like I think she's still significantly above the rest of the field.
Yeah, I'd put her as a favorite, but you know, not as big as she was.
I would say like she's a favorite as the world number one, but I don't think she is like. I think if we were to actually like have a predictions game or type of thing, like we would definitely see a lot of variation. And it obviously will depend on how well other players do, like on the warm-up tournaments, like Osaka, for example. Should she be actually like interested and eager to win and fit and hope actually plays a couple matches, I think she could still like pull herself above and really come back and win another one. I don't think that's too far from her to do that. So, but yeah, like right now in terms of form, I would still, if I had to put my money on somebody, definitely probably would be Iga Świątek at this point.
Yeah. Osaka is an interesting player to watch going forward because, I mean, this is her favorite time of the season, the hard courts. She recently split with her coach, Wim Fassett. I think they had been together for a few years. And later today, she's playing Zhang, who took a set off Świątek at Roland Garros. She was doing such a great job of hitting the ball with pace and weight, but also throwing in drop shots. So that's a very tough match right away, mm-hmm. Which will be interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And Świątek, Osaka, I think it's easy to forget, like, she made the Miami final this year. Yeah. Like, she had, like, when she's been healthy and when she's been motivated, she hasn't played bad. Like, you know, at the Australian Open, she lost from two match points up to, you know, Amanda Anisimova, who's having an amazing year and played a fantastic match. So I think it's really good that she's playing San Jose, Toronto, Cincinnati. I think she'll definitely get a lot of matches in. The coach thing, I hope she figures, you know, someone out, like, you know, that can help her, I think, during this time. But I think her tennis is, like, right there. Like, you know, no coach, I think, is going to really, like, there's not, like, many issues in her game that you'd need to, like, really, really fix.
Yeah. I think she's saying her dad is her primary coach now, who, mm-hmm. and he had been in the past. So she said, like, it's going to be nice to return to that. I think she said she, like, mm-hmm. felt a bit less pressure when working with him. And yeah, it's...
I still think when she's playing her best tennis, I think mm-hmm. she's the best player on hard court.
Yeah,
just hard court alone.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Miami final makes me feel a little less like that just because Świątek mm-hmm. was so imperious in that final. But yeah, mm-hmm. I largely agree with you. Like, it's easy to forget, given what's happened in the past year, she's won two of the last three U.S. Opens and two of the last three Australian Opens. Yeah. Like, that's dominant. So, or two of the last four.
I do think that she was far below, not far below, but she was considerably below her best, like in the Miami final, that she was a lot more vulnerable than she would normally be. But yeah, obviously, like, Świątek did fantastic job otherwise, because as you said, like, she's reached the final. Maybe she was a bit tired, as in my eyes she was, but, like, no, nothing, all credit to Świątek, because if she played a poorer level, definitely Osaka would have been back in that match for sure. So yeah. And I'm gonna piggyback, I'm gonna steal your segue, Vansh. As we spoke about home tournaments before, there was another guy that everyone is happy to see playing well, and he was also playing in his home tournament.
When I was talking about the home tournament, by the way, I just wanted to mention this stack from this final in the Prague tournament, because Mary Buskova was who I was referring to, who won Prague, not Krejcikova, who won it last year, but Mary Buskova wins the final against Anastasia Ponapova, hitting zero winners. I've never seen that before in a final of an event at any level, to be honest. So it was just quite crazy to see, because you know, Ponapova is obviously, like, a really big hitter, and she beat Kondovate earlier in the week, but in this final she really didn't play a good match, and she made 12 winners and 44 unforced errors. And Mary Buskova, just, I don't think this is how she always plays, like, kind of like a Madison Pringle, where it's just, you know, sort of waiting for your opponent to implode. But I think in this case, she probably did it really well and won 6-0, 6-3. So just wanted to throw that in there.
It's a cool example of how, like, there's not a right or wrong way to win a tennis match. Like, you can absolutely win barely hitting any winners. You know, forced errors is not a stat we see very often, but those are very relevant. And you can mm-hmm. also win by just letting your opponent implode. Like, that should not be spoken of as sort of like an improper or, like, lesser way to win a match, because it can be absolutely devastatingly effective.
Like, the more you get into the mind of your player, of your opponent, like, the better it is for you. Like, you don't want to, like, of course, like, you, for the fan, it's always better, like, see a Titanic match in which, like, both players are actually, like, playing at their best and not giving much of an inch to their opponents. But, like, for the player, like, the less effort that they need to make in order to win a match, the better. So, if they are able to make the opponent play bad, well, that's the strategy that they will strive for. So, yeah, sort of like how Owen says about Djokovic all,
like,
the time.
Something I was thinking about recently was sometimes when I watch like the best players in the world play on both tours against a player who they're much better than, sometimes I'll think like, why aren't they like hitting close to the lines? Like, I know they can hit these shots. Like, why aren't they doing it? They're basically hitting down the middle. And then I'll realize after the match, which they probably win in straight sets, it's because they don't have to. Like, why would you hit close to the lines if you can win by hitting down the middle? Mm-hmm. Hitting down the middle is safer. So you should only do like what you have to do to win. Like, there's no need to crush a ball into the corner when hitting it like with 75% depth is enough to win the point.
Yeah, particularly if you're a little low on confidence, it doesn't hurt to hit to safer targets and still hit big and play aggressive, but just sort of, you know, have more margin in your game. And I think that's something a lot of tennis coaches say as well. So I think it's a good general base to have.
Yeah. And speaking of also margin, like, how do you guys rate Dominic Thiem now that we already settled that the segue was done?
just as a player or recently? I mean, I like what I've seen the last couple of tournaments. Like, he had a very, very rough patch for a long time, but I think he's made a couple quarterfinals, semifinals back-to-back now. He got a good win over Batista Agut, who's a high-ranked player. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, for me, Dominic Thiem is, like, such a feel-good top player. Like, he makes me really happy. Like, watching him play, you know, is, like, was one of my favorite things in 2020 and 2019 when he was at his best. And then, you know, seeing how he's sort of struggled with the wrist injury and then how he like re-injured it while he was coming back, and then how he's had to, you know, make some technical changes like to offset that injury. Like, he has really come a long way, I think, since when he was on that 10 match losing streak and when he lost to Hugo Delian in the first round of the French Open. I was really concerned because I was like, you know, we might not see him back to his best for a really long time and he might have to drop down at the lower level and play quite a bit. But actually, he played one challenger, won a match, lost the next one, and then played three of these 250s on clay, and he made it a quarterfinal, semifinal, and quarterfinal, and he beat some good players in there. And a lot of these matches were, you know, swing seesaw type matches, three setters, where he got to hit a lot of balls, he got to work a lot on his forehand, his backhand has always been pretty good, like even throughout this whole year, and especially down the line, and he can do a lot of damage with it just in rallies, and he has a lot more variety on that wing. And now he's, you know, now he's like halved his ranking and he's in the top 200. And I think that's a big deal for him, because I think looking at next year or by the clay season next year or by even the Australian Open, I think we could really see him making a push, because I think the physicality is getting better. And I think even though he didn't win any of these tournaments, I feel pretty good. I was feeling really good after Stad when he got to the semis and played Berrettini, and Berrettini played like an amazing match and beat him in straight sets. But then in this tournament, I actually thought playing at home, I think there was a lot of added pressure that he probably felt, especially because looking at his draw, it seemed like, you know, he was going to get to the final just purely because of how that draw was and how he was playing. But he actually never really looked quite free to me, like throughout the whole week. He only played three matches. And in the third match against Yannick Hanfmann, that was a match which was which I think he probably feels like he should have won, because he had two break points to, and then he would have served for the match, and I think he had the momentum and he'd won the second set, and then there was like a rain delay, and then Hanfmann like came back at him, and I think it was a little tough because he, you know, at his best, I think what he likes to do is stand really far back on the return and hits with a lot of depth, and then just steps on that baseline right after that and is just pummeling forehands. And I think he couldn't quite find that balance because he was trying to adjust and actually try to return closer in. But every time he tried to do that, he couldn't really get a great read on the backhand return. And Hanfmann's kick serve was bothering him a bit, and he wasn't getting the depth that he normally does on his return. And so he was kind of indecisive about whether he should stay in and, you know, block the return or whether he should go back. And every time he went back, his return wasn't landing deep enough. So Hanfmann was doing a lot of damage on the plus one or hitting a drop shot afterwards. Yeah. And I think that was just something that I noticed. And, you know, maybe the big point play wasn't quite as sharp in terms of week to week, like he had done from Stad to Kitzbühel and, you know, or the previous two tournaments. So I think it doesn't really matter in the long term. You know, he may have missed a slight chance, but, you know, I think his goal is much bigger than another Kitzbühel title. And then RBA won that title and played really well. But
yeah.
But now I think he's going to play Cincinnati and Winston-Salem, and he's going to give it a go at the U.S. Open. And if he gets some momentum in those two tournaments, he could be dangerous in the U.S. Open in the first week. You know, I don't think a top player would want to draw him if he's got this much confidence. So.
I think crucially the forehand is coming back like that. It's still not at the levels it was, but now I think when he hits it, it's got that punch behind it again.
Which it's the forehand that I was looking at, and he seemed the least comfortable. But I guess, as you say, it was probably a little tight as well. And it's the home tournament and probably a little bit of tightness because of the injury. There's probably something that he evaluates almost on a daily basis, just to make sure that everything is in place. And so, definitely the forehand was lacking quite a bit of spin, as he normally used to, back in 2020, when that forehand was just massive. So I guess that's the one thing that he's lacking a bit. His attacking game is a little off, but obviously it's something that probably gets with match practice as well. Hopefully the spin is not something that is too much affected by his wrist injury. Hopefully something that he's able to get back, because it was a major part of his game. But also very, very optimistic about the way that he's been moving and defending. His defenses have been pretty insane. Not a lot of players have been able to hit through him. And if he's already been able to win points by just putting the ball back in, he's just one step closer to being able to become a player that will most likely be back into the top 10 at some point if he can get his attacking levels to the same level as he used to be, because his defense is pretty much settled. So it's a very good, there's just nothing much to say about it.
Yeah,
and I imagine you're probably making a lot of adjustments when you go through an injury like that on your forehand, just small little technical things that maybe you kind of have to go back and remember sort of how you used to hit that shot before. And you're kind of maybe doubting yourself a little bit more because you're afraid of re-injuring it again, or you want to make sure that your forehand is back to its optimal level. But I think he's getting closer to figuring that out, and he's doing a little bit more damage with it than he used to before. He was very, very passive with it sort of earlier in the season.
Yeah.
And that was the one difference.
Yeah. Yeah. No, go on. I was going to
go ahead, Andre.
Switch topics. So if you want to say something more. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was too. What did you guys think about the final between Carlos Alcaraz and Dionne Exum?
Yeah, I think bigger picture though for Carlos, right? A lot of people were sort of wondering, why is he playing these tournaments post Wimbledon? And I was trying to figure that out as well. But then I sort of realized that he actually hasn't played that much the whole year, because he skipped a lot of the pre warm ups before the Australian Open. He didn't play Rome, and he's that been pretty huge, wise about managing his schedule. And when he played Hamburg, he was far from his best in some of those matches. I mean, he beat Khachanov 6-0, 6-2, and he was getting closer to his level. And then he lost to Musetti. But you're thinking, okay, maybe you'll just rest, get ready for the hard courts. But I think he wanted to go and defend Umag as well. So then he plays there, and he sort of kind of the same way. I think we finally saw him sort of show what's very common for a lot of younger players, which is, sort of, he created these, he did such amazing things earlier in the year, in Madrid and, Indian Wells and Miami, and winning those four titles. And then now he's sort of, I don't want to say reverted, but he's sort of showing that, there's still a ways to go before he's quote unquote going to dominate the game, people are saying. And maybe those expectations are too high in the beginning, but I don't really think it changes much for him, long term. I think these are just two finals in isolation. He still got to top four. He's still two in the race. He's still, probably has a realistic chance of finishing the year number one or number two, just looking at the rest of the field right now.
Your possible world number one is overhyped at the end of the year.
So I think it's crazy to say that he's overhyped when he's achieving these things at 19. I mean, he's probably the best prospect since Djokovic. He's probably the most accomplished teenager since Nadal. I mean, those are just the facts that the stats bear out. And now it just, and he can lose, just because do we have to have this conversation every time he loses a match that he's overhyped? I mean, I just think if you just look at his losses this year, right? He's lost twice to Sinner now, and just, this is the first time he's lost from a setup. like in any of his matches. Yeah. And just he had one bad loss. That was to Korda in the first round of Monte Carlo, like in mm-hmm. intense wins. Yeah. After playing in Miami, like I think that's and fine. You know,
bearing in mind that like he won, I think the first five finals that he's played. So he was obviously due to like one yeah. loss here and there. Like obviously he, you could say that in a sense those are bad losses. Like, but like obviously Sinner is not a bad loss. Actually, Sinner is obviously a top 10 player. He's solid. He's only 20 years old as well. So like Sinner has had his own figuring out to do. So seems like he's getting there. Sinner yeah. seems to be. A much older player, just because it's been kind of pretty much up there for a while now. Kind of like in a sense, like how people used to talk about Felix and how long has it been there? It's just 21 years old, but like yeah. So those are the things that like those players need to figure out. And Sinner was able to figure out how to win ugly pretty much last year, and then he's kind of figuring out how to like bring his best level as well, so that he can actually keep up with like. Those best players and take a chance when they're not playing their best or like exploring the shots that those players kind of like yeah. maybe are struggling with, such as like the Alcaraz second serve or the Alcaraz serve like in general. So yeah,
Sinner for me is like it's interesting, like because you know a lot of people have sort of been like, you know, his year overall, like this was the first time he got past the quarterfinals of like any event. And like, you know, this was his first title, but mm-hmm. actually he's had like a really good year. Like if you look yeah. at it, it's just that he's not, you know, he's not been healthy for like mm-hmm. big parts of it. Like I remember in Miami, he wasn't like really healthy. And at the French Open, he was like destroying Rublev. And then, you know, then he got hurt, mm-hmm. which was kind
couldn't
of unfortunate.
Couldn't even finish the match, yeah.
Couldn't even finish the match. So like, and he's just, mm-hmm. he's just improved, you know, a lot. Like, you know, his baseline consistency, his serve is getting better and better every time I watch him. And he's got such a like calm demeanor and like such an even game, like his baseline game off of both.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Wings and how he's returning and now he's figured out, now he's done some things in both matches that I think are quite notable. I think it's pretty healthy actually for the game to have Alcaraz sort of like raise the level to a point where like you're now seeing Musetti and Sinner raise their game as well. And Musetti actually said that after the Hamburg final. He said, you know, Alcaraz, we've seen Alcaraz's strides this year and we're motivated mm-hmm. by it. So I think it's healthy for the sport because you want to see these rivalries. And I think Sinner and Alcaraz, if we get that in the next 10 years, like, sign me up because I love the way their games match up.
Yeah, it's like there's a new urgency like when they play. Like they see what Alcaraz is doing and they go from thinking like, I have however many number of years to like make every part of my game click, but they see him and they're like, oh, he's doing it already. So like I need to get going now. And Sinner has kind of been blowing my mind because I used to think like his peak level was his issue and like everything was pretty good. But like if he came up against a peaking rival, he was going to lose. And then at Wimbledon, he beats Alcaraz in four. He takes two sets off of Djokovic and he's doing little things like he's sliding on grass. He's hitting like these Del Potro-esque running forehands. He's blasting.
Still doing that, by the way. So if he can keep that up. Wow.
Exactly. And now in Umag, he breadsticks Alcaraz twice in a row. So any doubts about his peak level are completely gone. He's doing great. Like as far as Alcaraz goes, I think it's as simple as like earlier this year, he was in a purple patch. Everything was working. That is maybe not the case anymore. Yeah. Doesn't really alter how I feel about him long term. Like you are going to have peaks and dips in your form. It happens to everyone. He's still, like you said, Vaughn's still like number two in the race. So
and he made two finals in a row. Like, come on, like it's not a bad result. Like,
Like, this is bad for him.
Yeah, and he was not playing well in most of these matches. So on one hand, you could look at it and be like, okay, that's a sign of like a great player, because he could have easily lost in the first round of Hamburg. He could have lost in a semifinal where he rolled his ankle and it seemed doubtful that he was even going to play the final. And then he recovered from that and won the third set. And he had all the pressure on him as well. And then, you know, in this match, I guess if we can break it down, he was playing, they both were kind of not really having a solution on the other guy's serve throughout the first set, and it just went to a tiebreak. And Alcaraz plays this unbelievable set point. He's up 5-1 in the tiebreak, and Sinner comes all the way back, and you're thinking, oh no, this has gotten really complicated. And Sinner hits this ridiculous first serve, like out wide on the ad side. Alcaraz gets it back, like a great return. Sinner hits a really good plus one, comes forward, and out of nowhere, I don't know how Alcaraz did it, like very few in the game can do this, and he hits like this insane cross-court forehand on the stretch, on the defense, and Sinner misses the volley, and you know, maybe he could have moved closer in and maybe done a bit better there, but my goodness, how did he get that ball back?
Yeah, and I want to talk a bit about Sinner's turnaround in the second set, because he was down 0-1, serving at 0-1, and then Alcaraz hits three winners in a row to get to love 40, three break points. Had something like six break points in the game.
And the shot at love 30 was ridiculous as well, right?
Yeah, he hit that passing winner off of an overhead. Yeah. So demoralizing, right? Like, momentum is against you, like down break points, and not because you really screwed up, because your opponent is peaking. So what do you do there? And Sinner gets out of all the break points, holds, then breaks Alcaraz in the next game and never looks back. Like, that's ice cold stuff. Very, very impressed with him. Really excited to see what both of them do at the U.S. Open, because I feel like maybe not in the top tier of title contenders quite yet, but like just a shade below that. Like, I think, you know, if a Nadal goes out or if Medvedev goes out, either of them could win the title. I think in terms of winning like seven best of five matches in a row, like, don't think they're quite there yet, but they're getting very close.
Yeah. Something, if you do want to be critical of Alcaraz, something in this game, you know, kind of the amount of returns he was missing on these big points and just how his game went off the boil was something I hadn't seen. And I think mentally this was one of the worst matches he's played, which is like, you know, I mean, if this is the worst, then I guess that says, it says everything about the hype. But like, you know, at 15:40, Alcaraz misses the second serve backhand return in the net. And then at deuce, like Alcaraz finally makes that return. And you're thinking, oh, you should have made that at 15:40, you know? And then, you know, and then he has Sinner saves three more big points, but I think on three of those points he missed the same backhand return over and over, like on the second serve, and he kept on trying to take it really early, like he would sort of on a hard court and just like on the rise. I think he would have been better off, like, you know, maybe standing a few feet behind the baseline and just like playing that shot with more margin, because I did feel like in the baseline rallies I'd been going sort of back and forth about this, like, where did Sinner have the edge in this rivalry if you looked at it before? And I always thought, okay, maybe it's backhand to backhand, but then I started to see Alcaraz like do some amazing things at this backhand like throughout the whole season. So I was like, is Alcaraz's backhand like actually better than Sinner's? Because, like, you know, and then I saw this matchup twice, and I'm starting to think, okay, actually Sinner does really sort of have that edge backhand to backhand, and his baseline consistency is just sort of superior at the moment. And every time Alcaraz had attacking shots that he could do something with on the back end, he was just like missing a lot of them, or he was, you know, sometimes the forehand can be like the shot that breaks down for Alcaraz. He can make a lot of errors sort of in big moments. And then he sort of, for his plan B, he sort of goes to the drop shots quite a bit. And, you know, that's apart from that, I think he just needs to play with a little more margin. You know, he's such a great athlete. He can use his speed a lot more than he is right now in some of these situations. And like, I think he'll figure it out.
I think that for Alcaraz, the issue that I might see, like, with him in a sense, and it's not necessarily some sort of an issue, it's more like just fine tuning his game in that sense, is just because I feel like he suffers from like over eagerness. So like he gets so excited that sometimes he just kind of like wants to go for that shot, and maybe that's not the best decision. But like, as in, like, this, the fact that he's won two of the four Masters 1000s that he's played this year, like, makes it such that, like, we know that he is capable of making good shots and good decisions, but sometimes he comes up short. Like, as in, like you said, like, and maybe when he's not playing his best, like, he might come crashing a little too hard, and just like kind of like regulating his level and just like his state of mind during a match, like that has so much emotions like this, and like when he's not maybe not playing well, or he has a chance to go like for a shot that could break and maybe decide the match, like that's something that maybe he needs to kind of like just mentally adjust. But it's not an adjustment that I don't think that he will make. On the contrary, I think that he will make it and be good to go like by next year, like as early as next year, maybe even this year. He should be able to like pull it off. I'm excited to see like how he does it like in the ATP finals.
And like you said, it's good to remember he's won 2 Masters 1000s this year, because that is more than Stan Wawrinka has won in his entire career. So like that's the sort of thing that should be remembered when you talk about him being overhyped or not. Like, I think for me, the thing that's been hurting him this year is that when he has a lull, it kind of tends to last a while. Like, if you look at his losses, Berrettini at the Australian Open didn't really get going until halfway through the second set. Zverev at Roland Garros, like, didn't really get going until the third set. Sinner at Wimbledon, same thing. And then in this match, like, good in the first set, good at the start of the second set, not really so good for the rest of the match. And so I think if he can limit those lulls when he has them to, like, a few games or one set rather than two sets, I think he'll be much, much harder to beat.
Yeah, and then, of course, like you said, it's just sort of fine-tuning. Like, you know, no one is saying he's going to dominate the sport now. Like, he's 19.
Yeah.
So if he's not, like, you know, maybe you can come back to me in 2 years, and if he hasn't made a slam final by then we can sort of have that discussion again, and then, you know, maybe then we can sort of recalibrate. But it seems like, you know, he's like some of those things, like, you know, his serve, like his spot serving can get a little bit better, the consistency when he's not playing, when he doesn't have his game, so he doesn't go off the boil that dramatically for that long, I think is something he can work on for sure. And then, you know, just like sort of those panic drop shots and sort of,
But like even like, Djokovic used to hit like a lot of panic drop shots like back in his day. Pretty sad to see. Like, he did a lot of those this against Nadal, and so many times just because like Nadal was so good at, like, defending. But yeah, like, it's, I guess it's pretty normal. And here you go, another comparison between Alcaraz and Djokovic.
Yeah, I mean, like, drop shots are kind of funny. Like, I mean, Federer has a very famous quote where he says, like, it's kind of a panic shot, I thought back in the day. And, like, I think it can be a panic shot, but, like, when the drop shots kind of flow naturally as part of everything else, and are just, like, another way to finish a point rather than, like, the central way to finish a point, they work, they're devastating. Like, I mean, the way Alcaraz has used them this year, like, other players started to pick up on it and started to do it as well. Like, it completely keeps your opponent guessing, because, like, if you can either hit, like, a massive forehand or a drop shot that's going to die a foot over the net, like, what are you supposed to do? So, like, I do agree that sometimes when things aren't working, like, he'll get a little trigger happy with the drop shots, hit some bad ones, but, I mean, for the most part, it's an amazing shot.
Yeah. And then, I mean, Sinner, the way he was playing in that third set, he just sort of, that was peak Sinner, like, at the very end. You know, once Alcaraz lost the serve, he never looked back. He never even gave Alcaraz a sniff. And he was, you know, so steady from the back of the court and doing so much damage. That running forehand that you're talking about, it's on path to be, like, the next best, you know, running forehand combo. Like, you know, it's kind of reminding me of Del Potro. Like, if he can keep it up and do this, keep on doing this after in every tournament, along with the improvements in his serve and his, and just, I just love how he hits to such big targets, but he's still playing really aggressive. And you feel like he has a lot more margin in his game. And he's not missing nearly as much, but it's still really potent. Like, his speeds on his forehand and backhand ground strokes are, like, about the same. It's very even off both wings. So that's something that's really, really positive. And then obviously his mentality, like, when he's down low 40, and I've seen him escape and save many match points and save, you know, come up with big serve plus ones and big points. And I think now that he has Darren Cahill on his team as well, I think that's pretty big, because Darren Cahill knows how to win big matches.
For sure.
Having coached many, many players in the past. And he actually said something really interesting in commentary. Ravi Uba, I think, mentioned this, but he was saying that Darren Cahill was saying that playing on the clay before you go to the hard courts is an easier transition than going from hard to clay, in a sense. Because on the clay, you can sort of work on your consistency, you can work on your fitness, you can work on sort of building and constructing points, and then it's easier to sort of transfer that you know, that knowledge and that that match play, it's easier to do that in hard court. So it's kind of interesting because normally at this time of the year, you think, oh, you know, post-Wimbledon clay doesn't really mean a whole lot, but I think it can actually be quite useful for a player like Sinner, who has such a strong base. And you can probably go from clay to hard, like, no problem.
Yeah. So do you guys want to make some US Open predictions? It's a long way off, but I mean, I guess we can talk about that more generally. Like, I guess for each tour, like, who are three players who you expect to kind of win the lion's share of the big titles for the
I think
rest
the US
of the
Open
year?
Is really up for grabs.
Oh, for the rest of the year or just leading up to the
year? Yeah, but like ATP and WTA, like, who are the three players who are going to be the best in the world from now until the end of the season?
Well, I think for the men's, you know, you have to look no further than Nadal. I mean, if he's like somewhat decently healthy, I guess, in Canada, you can't really rule him out. The way he's played all year, and he won the US Open in 2019, and he's won Canada like 5 times, and we just kind of have to see like how Washington and these other two tournaments go. But I think, you know, having no matches right now, like for any of them, I'd have to say like Nadal, Medvedev, and then third, maybe Alcaraz. Like, I can't really think. I mean, Sinner is a great candidate, but I feel like, you know, he still has ways to go in terms of his fitness and best of five. And I need to see, you know, more from him, like, in these next 2 weeks for me to like really be putting him up there. And in terms of the contenders, I guess there's no Djokovic as well.
Yeah.
Most likely.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, to the end of the year, Nadal's, if he's healthy, like, definitely like top three. I think Medvedev, I think he could still like do some damage by the end of the year. He normally plays well during this time anyway, so I think he can still defend his title even in the US Open. I think he'll be excited about it.
He hasn't won a title this year, which is kind of interesting to think about.
Yeah, he's lost his last 5 finals, but he's playing this year in Los Cabos, which is a 250 in Mexico instead.
I would definitely pick
Washington.
I'll definitely pick Nadal and Medvedev, and I think Tsitsipas could be like a third one. Maybe Alcaraz, like, depends on like who's more consistent. Like, Tsitsipas hasn't been as consistent, but like if he picks it up, I think it could be sort of like on a good level.
This is usually the part of the year where Medvedev
is
incredible, and Tsitsipas is sort of the first half of the year where he's really good, and then this half of the year he sort of goes away a little bit. But I think that because people aren't talking about him and the expectations are low, he could actually do something.
Yeah, but Tsitsipas has been to the final of Canada once and to the semifinal last year, and he's won the ATP finals before. So I don't think that he's that far off, like, reaching his a good level in there. Like, if he's finding, if he can find like whatever is bothering him, like, in his game that he's not able to like play as well or like be as effective. So
I think it's good that he hasn't played in many tournaments. Like, he hasn't played any tournaments the last 4 or 5 weeks. Because he usually plays quite a bit, so it's good that he's kind of taking this time off. I think he'll be ready to be more fresh than a lot of players this time.
Yeah, great opportunity to break out of the slump at the very least. I agree with you guys. I feel like Nadal, you have to put up there. Medvedev usually does well this time of the season, and then number three, like, still lean Alcaraz a little bit over Sinner, but I think Sinner could absolutely take that spot if he continues the way he's been playing. Then thoughts on the...
Oh, and just a note here that, like, I don't think Djokovic has dropped his levels, just he's not playing. So, like, there's not much to say in here out of the fact that he unfortunately cannot compete. But, yeah, back to the WTA, it's just... Iga Świątek and the rest. I don't really know exactly, like, what to say. Like, kind of lost track a little bit. Like, who's number two right now? Is it Anett Kontaveit? I think Ons Jabeur is going to be up there.
It's Ons. I'm curious to see where her head is at when she plays in San Jose. I think we'll learn a lot more with these. Like, generally, the players who have done pretty well in these warmups have done, like, I think back to Andreescu when she won Canada, and then she won the US Open, and years before. Like, I think Osaka still, like, I just cannot rule her out, especially if she plays well these next 3 weeks. I think she has to be, like, there in the top three for me.
Who do you think is going to end in the ranking?
Maybe Anisimova? I don't know. Anisimova, Fernandez. Sure. Kind of hard to tell.
Or are you asking about Huron's number one?
Who's going
to
finish top three, I guess, like in the WTA, you think?
Top three. That's a good question, because the rankings... So, I mean, Iga has a lead of almost 4,000 points. And then after that, 2 through 5 are all within 500 points of each other. It's Kontaveit, Sakkari, Badosa, and Jabeur in that order. I feel like Jabeur could make the leap from 5 to 2. She's been great. Three, I really don't know. Because after Jabeur, it's Sabalenka, Pegula, Muguruza, Collins, and Raducanu to finish the top 10. And like none of them have particularly been huge factors in the biggest tournaments this year. You know, Collins at the Australian Open. But besides that, I mean, Pegula has been very consistent, but I don't know if I see her as a top three player quite yet. I feel like Sakkari could stay in
the by elimination, like Sakkari ends up like in the top three. Sort of like Kontaveit. Kontaveit, by the way, has a ton of points to defend at the end of the year right now. So,
That monster indoor season last year. But I mean, not just that, but Sakkari has done some great things this year. I mean, I think Indian Wells final. I think she's come close to some titles, like hasn't had that breakthrough yet. But I strongly believe that if she continues like with the level she's been at, she will she will make that breakthrough at some point.
I was looking at the race and I see you know, Jabeur is number two, Goff is number three, Pegula is number four, Sakkari is number five, and Kazakina is number six.
Goff could be another one for sure.
Badosa seven, like between like 2 and 7 is a gap of like 900 points, so it's like and then you have Świątek over 7,000, and Badosa is, I mean, Jabeur is 2,990, so, wow, like 4,500 points.
But, it's going to be interesting next year to see how Świątek does like, with all the points that she's won this year, but
I mean, at the same time, there will be places where she can pick up points, like Australian Open, Wimbledon, but yeah, I mean, with that much to defend, I think it's very rare that anyone follows up a season that dominant with an equally dominant season. But yeah, I think for me going forward the rest of the year, my eyes are most on Świątek, Osaka, and had the third one in my head and then completely forgot. And Jabeur, sorry. I feel like Jabeur and Świątek are the two most informed players on tour right now. And Osaka being so good on hard courts, I feel like at the very least she'll make one crazy run going forward the rest of the year, and at best she could be pretty dominant. So
It's interesting. I really put a little bit more stock on the WTA finals than I do in the ATP finals, but I do wonder who's gonna end up with that title. I feel like they really want it.
Who's even going to qualify? Because the way these draws are right now, you know, the way women's tennis is right now, you have amazing matches in the first week of a major or in the early rounds of these 500s and 1000s. And then, like, they sort of kill each other in the first week. And then you're sort of, you look at the second week and you're like, okay, so now these guys are there that I didn't expect. And then it's sort of like, so you have an amazing, awesome first week. And then you sort of have like a really good story in the second week, as opposed to like really awesome rivalries. But it's like a really good contrast, because I feel like how in the world, like because I'm just going through the race right now and I see like, you know, Ostapenko and Halep and Kontaveit and Collins, and these are like just right outside the top 10. And same with like, you know, Bencic and Badosa. Like these players have all done something or the other this year, like either made a final or won a title. Or like I think Świątek is the only player to have won more than one title. And then you have like Bernarda Pera Haddad Maia won two each. Like it's basically Świątek and the field. And then you're like if you were to sort of pick though between like Świątek and the field for the US Open, like who would you go for? Like for the French Open, it was more sort of 51. It was like more, you could lean more towards Świątek, but in this case I think it's closer.
I think it's tough. I
would
still
go with
the field.
I think
I'd go with the field too. I just feel like
that's fair.
Do you guys think Nadal is going to? I mean, this is absolutely 100% too soon to talk anything about Nadal, but Djokovic might not play. Do you guys think that Nadal wins ATP Finals this year? Finally, to complete like the the deck of cards.
I really don't know. I think honestly, a lot depends on his. Yeah. A lot depends on his injuries. A lot depends on kind of like that's the time of the year where he's like the most vulnerable. And you know, I thought he might do it in 2020, and but then you have like, I think that's the tournament
you,
where
do
like,
wonder,
the
like what
really
does Nadal
well. So think,
want to his career in his career at this point? Like, I mean, maybe he wants to widen the gap between him and Djokovic. Maybe he wants to complete like all of the big tournaments. Maybe he wants to just kind of have fun. I have no idea what Nadal wants at this point in his career. Like, zero clue.
Yeah, I think he does really want to win that tournament. Like, I remember in 2020 when he lost that semi to Medvedev, he was really upset. Uncommonly so. But I don't think it's going to happen for him. I like his chances at the US Open better than at the ATP Finals. Like, even Djokovic has not won this tournament since 2015. And Nadal's never won it, so... just gets tougher as you get older, and it's never been his best. So,
yeah, I think it would be like for him just staying healthy as long as he possibly can to like peak and win majors, and then just sort of if anything else feels like in sight, maybe just go for it. Like, I think the 1000s are don't mean that much to him like they used to, unless it's a build up to the French Open, and then ATP Finals if he's like really healthy at that time of the year.
I do think so. I definitely think he plays if he's healthy,
like
for sure.
Yeah, and he's gonna he has a good chance of finishing the year number one because he's
I think he will
that much farther ahead. Like, so, and Djokovic isn't gonna play much.
But yeah, Andre, it's kind of interesting to think about what he wants because he's had an amazingly successful year, and it kind of feels like he's been miserable for a lot of it with like that Indian Wells injury and the Wimbledon thing, like and the clay season, like his foot, like he was devastated after that. It kind of feels like a wildly passionate relationship that's doomed to fail in the end. You know what I mean? Like he's been so successful all his career in this year. And it feels like in theory, this is what you would want, right? Like he's won two of the three majors and yet it doesn't feel sustainable. Like, I think it's all the injuries are wearing on him more than they have in the past. So I have no idea like what he wants. I think I kind of feel like he just wants this, but with fewer injuries. So
I think he'll want to be helped. Happy for his nice little reunion with the Big Four Labor Cup.
That's going to be hilarious. Goodness. I can't wait to see who gets partnered up in doubles.
You just want to see like all those, you know, like I just want to see all the Big Four like play each other, like with each other in doubles. Like I want to see Djokovic and Nadal play once. I want to see Federer and Nadal.
All the same, it would be better if they were on opposite teams.
Because... they might just like make a
So who team came world up right with the now, idea of have, Europe versus world?
Right now we have Felix, Jack Sock, Diego Schwartzman, and Taylor Fritz. Kyrgios is not playing. He just announced
as
today,
hard as it is to say that, that is a guy that I would put to like win a match. Like the field as it is right now, it's rough.
I mean, even with that third set tiebreak thing to help Team World's chances, like it's not going to be enough. Like
they're
it was
just
so funny.
Need to rely on their double skills.
Yeah,
I guess that's why they probably have Jack Sock. But
yeah, it was. I mean, he'll pull his weight by a mile. But like it was funny because the first 2 years it was close, and then the third year it was like 12-1 or something, and it was like
last year was when I really felt like okay, this is a mismatch. Like the previous 3 years before that, I was like, okay, at least it came down to like whatever the last two games.
And
like,
I mean, to be fair, I think I would still have picked Jan Isner to go. Like,
I mean, he beat Nadal there in 2017. Like, you need someone like that.
I think I would still pick Jan Isner as well. I wonder if he'll play actually.
Yeah.
I wonder who the other two players will be as well.
Yeah, like I wouldn't be surprised if by the end of it they just put Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer in the doubles, like because why not? But
it's going to be interesting though because maybe like you know Murray not being the same player he used to be and Federer coming back after over a year, like maybe
I mean, if you have Djokovic and Nadal in the same team, maybe it's hard to even out like with pretty much anything.
You got to pair those two up, right?
If Nadal is like you know a little iffy with his injuries, and Djokovic is maybe rusty because he hasn't played like since Wimbledon, I'm not sure.
I think you have to pair off Djokovic and Nadal to like. Yeah. I mean, unless Federer comes back and is like serving as well as he ever has, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, which is possible, but you guys have anything else to add?
Not sure. I was just going to say that like a wild take would be for Nadal to skip the US Open and focus on ATP Finals. That's as wild a take as it ever gets.
I don't think he wants it that bad.
That is wild. Just go for the tournaments exactly. You've never won and just try to win those. But I mean, I guess the slam race is probably more important.
I do think that he wants to go for Wimbledon, I guess, one more time as well. I think that those could be like a few of his priorities, just like the Australian Open, in the sense that he took so long for him to win another one. Could be sort of the same for Wimbledon.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of going for things, isn't it great to see Serena and Venus play like three tournaments in a row?
I do think that they retired the US Open. Maybe not Serena, but Venus almost 100%.
Because they never thought they would play again. And now you have, like, even if Venus just plays four matches, it's just so great to see her back. Like, she doesn't need to be doing this. She's been on tour for 28 years.
And oh my God, that's like, ridiculous.
It's like two thirds of her life.
She's 28 years. I kind of feel like they won't retire at the end of the US Open. Like, I think Serena had a pretty good level at Wimbledon. And,
I honestly think that was the match of the tournament.
Her movement was good.
I think the match of the tournament was Tan versus Serena Williams.
Yeah.
And Serena Williams, I think, has realized that, okay, I can actually do really good things at the US Open if I just play in Cincinnati and Canada before. And she hasn't done that since 2015. So, like, she's really good.
Serena has just, like, all the good shots that she needs to succeed. She doesn't even need to be, like, that, like, fit in the sense, like, to be fast and running and defending. Yeah. She needs her serve to be going because it's the best serve ever on the WTA. And she needs her both ground strokes to be, like, firing as well. So she can punch return winners all the time, put pressure on any second serve out there. And she's gold. Like, she doesn't even need to run out that much, to be fair. So,
in a way, like, Venus's loss yesterday was kind of similar to Serena's to Tan. Like, because, you know, like, they played great. Like, they were in the match and it was like 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And so physically, you know, you think, okay, that's pretty positive. They haven't played in a year, but they just couldn't close, and that's normal if you haven't played in over a year.
Do you guys think Serena wins another Grand Slam?
I don't think she wins
it. I don't think so, but I think she could go for it. And I think if she survives the first three rounds or four rounds, I think she could absolutely get deep in the tournament, like similar to how she did in 2020 at US Open. She played Azarenka in the semifinals there, and then in 2021 Australian Open she made the semis there, and before that she made four finals. So I feel like
she could do it.
She can.
Chances are definitely slimmer, but who knows? Yeah, and I guess that's it.
Maybe this is her last one. Maybe it's not, but I think it's we should just cherish what all we
definitely have watching a few of the Serena matches. It's good that they played all the way until now, because that means that they will have HD matches for us to watch of those two now, and not just like those crappy 97, 98 matches that.
Where you can't see the scorecards
Great stuff, guys, and thanks for joining. This is always a good time to talk tennis with you guys, and excited to be back, and wish me luck. I'll be working at the National Bank Open, the Canadian Open, next week in Canada, so it'll be rough. Hopefully I'll see Nadal.
Yes.
And
after that, we'll do an episode detailing your experience and stuff.
Max,
pretty excited to review to review Canada with you, and hope you have a great time there. And you, you keep the Tennis Canada account awesome as it always is on Twitter.
Thanks, guys. I'll do my best, and see you guys later. You can follow us at Tennis and Bagels on Twitter. You follow Vansh at VanshP2K, and Owen is at Tennisation. Follow Popcorn Tennis at Popcorn_Tennis_1, if I'm not mistaken.
I think it's Popcorn_Tennis1. Okay, I'm not completely sure.
We'll put it in the description.
But if you put Popcorn Tennis,
it's definitely
in the
description. And they have over 1,000 followers now. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys later. Bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.